Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Philip Alexio reporting. U.S. President Donald Trump contending Sunday he never asked former Federal Bureau of Investigation Chief James Comey to stop investigating his one-time National Security Advisor Michael Flynn about his contacts with Russia's ambassador to Washington. Trump said Comey, whom he fired last May, lied when he testified to Congress in June that Trump had said to him, quote, "I hope you could see your way clear to letting this go, to letting Flynn go. He's a good guy. I hope you can let this go," unquote. Trump's Twitter remark, coming 2 days after Flynn pleaded guilty in Washington to lying to FBI agents about conversations he had with former Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak a year ago and the weeks before Trump assumed power in January. The United Nations has informed the United States has informed the United Nations that it will no longer participate in the Global Compact on Migration. In 2016, the 193 members of the UN General Assembly unanimously adopted a non-binding political declaration, the New York Declaration for Refugees and Migrants, pledging to uphold the rights of refugees and to help them resettle and ensure that they have access to education and jobs. But in a statement, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said that the program was not consistent with American immigration policies. A suicide blast kills at least 6 civilians in eastern Afghanistan on Sunday, wounding 13 others. The bomber was on a motorcycle trying to reach the venue of a massive pro-government rally in Jalalabad. That's the capital of Nangarhar province, a provincial government spokesman telling VOA one woman and one child were killed among the dead. You're listening to VOA News. The White House National Security Advisor says the possibility of war with impoverished but nuclear-armed North Korea is increasing every day because Kim Jong-un is getting closer and closer and there's not much time left. H.R. McMaster saying there are ways to address this problem short of armed conflict as he was speaking during a forum on national defense, which was moderated by Fox News' Brett Baer at the Ronald Reagan Library in Simi Valley, California.
And so it's immensely important that we work together with all of our allies, partners, everyone internationally, to convince Kim Jong-un that the continued pursuit of these capabilities is a dead end for him and his regime.
The Australian state of Victoria has become the first in the nation to legalize assisted dying. Terminally ill patients must be at least 18 years old and have less than 6 months to live. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Victoria State Health Minister Jill Hennessy said the state parliament had considered what a good death looks like. The assisted suicide law is designed for patients with a terminal illness who are in severe pain. It will allow them to obtain a lethal drug within 10 days of asking to die. They must administer the drug themselves, but a doctor can give the lethal dose where an individual is physically unable to end their own life. Victoria State Premier Daniel Andrews has praised the landmark legislation.
The Parliament has just made history. This is a day of giving control to those who are terminally ill and in the terminal phase of their life.
Critics of the landmark legislation said it was a recipe for elder abuse, while some doctors believe it will deny patients the right to receive palliative care, care for people who have serious illnesses. Phil Mercer for VOA News.
The UN Refugee Agency reports the number of refugees that have fled into Zambia to escape militia violence in Haut-Katanga and Tanganyika provinces of the Democratic Republic of Congo now has topped 12,000, indicating a rather worsening situation in southeastern DRC. Government forces reportedly are killing many civilians in response to the rebellion in Haut-Katanga against the continued rule of the country's President Joseph Kabila. Nigerian officials said two female suicide bombers infiltrated a busy shopping area in the town of Biu, about 185 kilometers south of the Borno State capital of Maiduguri, a stronghold of the Boko Haram militant group. One of the bombers detonated in Biu's main market, while the other set off her bomb outside the market square, according to a local police spokesman. I'm Philip Alexio in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Now we have a new Minister of Foreign Affairs who is actually a member of the military junta. So it is not a fresh start at all. It is very much the continuation of the old, and we cannot say that the investors can have confidence in such a government.
Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa drops two ministers from his cabinet.
During his administration, corruption has become rampant, the state has become captured, and despite President Zuma being implicated in many of the events and occurrences of corruption, he has neither resigned nor taken any steps against other people implicated in corruption.
South African President Jacob Zuma says his administration is working hard to stop corruption.
So the position of the party remains that we support the electoral reform bill 100%. We would want any person who is elected as president of this country to have the legitimacy, to have the support from across the nation.
And Malawi's main opposition party denies media reports it is pushing against electoral reforms under consideration by parliament. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Yesterday, Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa dropped two ministers that he had just appointed to his cabinet. The move was widely seen as a response to uproar over the nominations. Critics say they were recycled from the Mugabe administration and unpopular with the public. The president's new cabinet, which he named on Thursday, also included two military men. He's expected to appoint two vice presidents following a special ZANU-PF Congress in mid-December. For reaction, I reached Douglas Mwanzora, spokesman for the Zimbabwean former prime minister and main opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai in the capital Harare.
This is very much a continuation of Mugabe's government. The people who were put there were simply a recycling of the old cabinet that was there. But most important is that there has been increased militarization of key state institutions. Three of the people in cabinet now were offenders during the genocide in Matabeleland in the early 80s. It is also a cabinet that is extremely gender insensitive, three women out of 22 ministers. It is also a cabinet which displays a lot of favoritism. People who are well-known supporters of the president now have now been rewarded. It is an extremely, extremely bad cabinet. We see no youth at all. So for us, this is a continuation of Mugabe's legacy, a poor imitation, actually, of Mugabe's legacy.
However, some people in the ZANU-PF are saying that this is an inspiring government and this will urge investors to come to Zimbabwe because this is a fresh face.
It must be remembered that President Mnangagwa was a key member of Mugabe's cabinet since 1980. He has been there for 37 years with Mugabe. He very much shares the blame of what went on. So it is not a new thing at all. And also, now we have a new Minister of Foreign Affairs who is actually a member of the military junta. So it is not a fresh start at all. It is very much the continuation of the old, and we cannot say that the investors can have confidence in such a government. And I want to say that the MDC views the indications by the West, the willingness to engage this government at this point in time is simply not fair. What the West must do is to engage with Zimbabwe and with this government on a quid pro quo basis. What I mean is that they must, whatever they are going to give, it must be married with a positive action on the side of human rights for Zimbabwe.
Some people are saying that the MDC, yes, led by former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai, is displeased because the international community appears to want to deal with Emmerson Mnangagwa and his nascent government.
Well, we think that there is some fickleness that we see in the readiness of the international community to deal with Emmerson Mnangagwa. What he has done to justify that, he must prove that he is going to have free and fair elections. He is going to level the playing field. He is going to forestall violence and intimidation, and that he is not going to militarize key state institutions. If he does not do that, then the international community will be doing Zimbabweans harm by engaging in a government that is pretty much the same as the old one.
After he named his cabinet, there was a reaction from Zimbabweans. He came back with a mini reshuffle, moving some people around. Some people are saying this is a departure from what President Robert Mugabe used to do, and that this is a reflection of the new paradigm in Zimbabwe.
No, unfortunately, what President Mnangagwa did was a display of lack of knowledge in the constitution. The constitution of Zimbabwe allows him to select five ministers outside parliament. In his first cabinet, he had eight people who are not in parliament, and he had to remove them. It's not because of the pressure of the people. It's because of the realization of the legal reality. So what he had done was legally incompetent. So when you are correcting yourself for doing something legally incompetent, it cannot be termed as sensitivity to the people. He had made a constitutional blunder, which he was correcting.
What is your next line of action following what some people are saying, an embrace of Mnangagwa? Because before President Robert Mugabe was forced to resign, people were saying anybody but Mugabe. What is next for the MDC? Do you have what it takes to win next year's election based on the new wind blowing in Zimbabwe?
We hoped that there would be a new wind blowing. It is the old wind. The state remains the same. The ruling party remains the same. The system remains the same. And in a space of 7 days, President Mnangagwa has made 7 monumental errors, giving $10 million to Mugabe, number one. Number two, declaring Robert Mugabe Day and prohibiting business. Number three, it is the militarization of the cabinet. The Air Force commander is now the Minister of Lands. There is actually a militarization of the key institutions. What the MDC wants is to continue its fight for electoral reforms, because we want to take over power through peaceful, democratic, and constitutional means. And we want the help of the international community to make sure that there are free and fair elections in Zimbabwe.
Douglas Mwanzora is the spokesman for the Zimbabwean former prime minister and main opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai. He spoke with me from Harare. South African President Jacob Zuma says his administration is working hard to stop corruption. Answering a question asked by a lawmaker Friday, the president said a number of measures are being implemented to curb corruption both in government and the private sector. Zuma's statement came amid growing calls for him to be held accountable for his alleged role in what has been labeled as a state capture by the Gupta family. President Zuma has rejected the calls and has dismissed accusations of pervasive corruption in his government and other state institutions. For reaction about the fight against graft, I reach parliamentarian James Self, the head of legal affairs of the South African main opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, or DA, in Johannesburg.
Well, it's absolutely preposterous and quite untrue, because during his administration, corruption has become rampant, the state has become captured, and despite President Zuma being implicated in many of the events and occurrences of corruption, he has neither resigned nor taken any steps against other people implicated in corruption. He keeps promising that he's going to appoint a commission of inquiry into the rampant and systematic corruption, yet he has not done anything about it. So it is one of the more bizarre statements that I have heard him utter.
He said that a plethora of measures had been adopted to eradicate corruption, so proud of his administration's achievement that he cited South Africa's 8th rank increase on the 2017 corruption barometer as an improvement over the past 4 years. Your take?
All that I can say is that the Corruption Watch must have adopted some extraordinary measures to have achieved that, because billions of rands are stolen from this country every year through corruption and corrupt activities. And we are coming to grips with it in one of our governments in Johannesburg, where we took over the municipal government last year, where we have thus far interdicted and prevented a total of 18 billion rands worth of corrupt activities, but we are only scratching the surface. So if that is happening in a municipal government, one shudders to think what is going to be the case in the national government when we take that over.
He also said that allegations of corruption usually leveled against him by the Democratic Alliance, or the DA, as well as the EFF, are misleading and inaccurate.
It's not only the DA and the EFF that raise those issues. It's also the public protector, who very famously ordered him to pay back money on the improvements to his private residence, to which he was not entitled. It's also Common Cause, through another report of the public protector, that he has enjoyed a close and unhealthy relationship with a certain family of investors in South Africa, and that contracts from government services have been given to companies associated with that family. So it is truly amazing that he is in a position without any embarrassment to come up with assertions of that nature.
There are some people who have said that President Zuma should face an inquiry into allegations of state capture. What is your take?
We are all for a commission of inquiry into those allegations. The issue here is a complex one, because he has power in terms of our constitution to appoint commissions and appoint their members and determine their terms of reference. But because he himself has implicated, the public protector ordered that the judge that was to be appointed to head up this inquiry should be appointed by the Chief Justice and not by the President. Now, we believe that that is the correct way to go, because no one can be the judge in his own matter. And as a consequence, President Zuma has taken this matter on review to the High Court. We expect the High Court's ruling by the middle of this month, and then we will see how this commission is going to be constituted.
He said his administration had adopted a multi-agency approach on which comprehensive anti-corruption architecture had been created and a resilient anti-corruption system was in place, quickly pointing out that he established in 2010 the Anti-Corruption Interministerial Committee led by then-minister in the presidency, Jeff Radebe, and was supported by existing government mechanisms. Your take?
There's a very, very simple test of the efficacy of that. How many people have actually been prosecuted? How many people have gone to jail? How much money has been recovered? I know of at least one occasion in the Department of Correctional Services where a senior official was investigated for corruption. There was a report that was issued in 2009. That official has still not yet been prosecuted in any way or form. So the claims that he makes are hollow. He is in fact lying to the public. His commitment to anti-corruption is transparently untrue. And sooner or later, this is going to catch up with him when he himself becomes prosecuted for 783 charges of corruption.
Parliamentarian Jill Self is the head of legal affairs of the South African main opposition party, the Democratic Alliance. He spoke with me from Johannesburg. The Malawi Congress Party, or MCP, the main opposition party, has denied local media reports that it is kicking against the electoral reforms tabled in Parliament. The proposed electoral reforms will ensure that a presidential candidate should attain over 50% of the total votes cast in order to be declared a winner by the Electoral Commission. But local media reports say leaders from the main opposition party are privately saying the MCP will be disadvantaged if the proposed measure were to become law. For the latest development, I reach Eisenhower Mkaka, the Deputy Secretary General and spokesperson for the Malawi Congress Party in the capital, Lilongwe.
The position of the party on 50 plus 1, which is just a small section of the reforms, has not changed. So the position of the party remains that we support the electoral reform bill 100%.
Does it mean that the MCP supports the 50 plus 1 threshold to win an election in the Republic of Malawi, as has been tabled in Parliament?
We support that provision 101%. We would want any person who is elected as president of this country to have the legitimacy, to have the support from across the nation, rather than having a support from a section of the nation. So 50 plus 1 is a move in that direction. So as Malawi Congress Party, we support that 101%.
Some of your critics are saying that the MCP has been hypocritical about some of these issues, because on the one hand, it says that the party is not ready for the 50 plus 1 threshold and that they cannot say it publicly, but privately they are saying so. Do you think those criticisms are justified?
Well, I think that would qualify to be called propaganda against Malawi Congress Party. You know, Malawi Congress Party is enjoying support across the country, and we just showed the world that we are enjoying that support across the nation in the 15th December by-elections, where we won 5 out of 6 cases where there was contestation. So for somebody to start saying that we are afraid of 50 plus 1 just because we think we cannot amass that, that is a lie. As Malawi Congress Party, we are quite comfortable. We've got support in all the 3 regions of the country. And we are saying with 50 plus 1, we would win the elections fair and square.
But opponents are saying the president, Professor Peter-Arthur Mutharika, appears to be popular and that he seems to be gaining momentum because of some economic policies that his government has implemented that ensures that the lives of Malawians have improved, and that it appears he stands a chance of being re-elected to serve the rest of his second full year term, and that the MCP is just making noise for the sake of making noise to stay relevant. Your take?
That is very laughable. If you ask an ordinary Malawian, they'll tell you they are going through hell at the moment. Macroeconomic factors or statistics have been manipulated and stuff like that. The reality on the ground is different. Malawians are going through hell, and they want change, and they want it yesterday. And it is not true that President Peter Mutharika is getting popular by the day. As a matter of fact, the president's popularity is dwindling by the day. He is no longer a darling of the people. So it is whoever would say that President Peter Mutharika is getting popular by the day is living in a fool's paradise.
You accuse the administration of manipulating economic figures to make it sound palatable to Malawians. However, you need to provide the empirical proof to buttress your accusation, because even international standards by Bretton Woods institutions appear to side with the government that the president, as his supporters say, performed an economic miracle by turning the economy around.
Right. If you want me to provide empirical evidence of my claim, I would just take you to the market. Just 6 months ago, a bag of cement was costing 6,500 Malawi kwacha. As I'm talking, a bag of cement is costing between 10 and 11,000 Malawi kwacha, when they are saying that inflation figures are going down. And the trend is the same in respect of the other commodities on the market. Now, we are asking, Which inflation figures are they talking about? Why is it that is showing on the ground that inflation figures are going down? So what I'm saying is the truth on the ground. They might have manipulated the figures on the ground. They played around with maize and stuff like that because they wanted the inflation figures to appear like they are going down. But the truth is, inflation is very high.
Eisenhower Mkaka is the Deputy Secretary General and spokesperson for the Malawi Congress Party. He spoke with me from Lilongwe. The UN Refugee Agency reports the number of refugees that have fled into Zambia to escape militia violence in two provinces of Democratic Republic of Congo now has topped 12,000. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The agency reports more than 8,400 Congolese refugees have arrived in Zambia in just the last 3 months, indicating a worsening of the situation in southeastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Government forces reportedly are killing many civilians in response to the rebellion in Haut-Katanga and Tanganyika provinces against the continued rule of the country's president, Joseph Kabila. To put the increasing instability in the country in perspective, UNHCR spokesman Babar Baloch notes more than 4 million people are internally displaced in DRC. He tells VOA within the past month alone, 200,000 more people have fled their homes.
When you do the math, the rough total of internal displacement comes to around 6,500 people being displaced each day. Refugees who are arriving, they fear that as violence is intensifying, they fear that more people could be forced out from DRC into Zambia.
Baloch says some 80% of the refugees are women and children, driven out by the extreme brutality of rampaging militias. He says civilians reportedly are being killed, women raped, property looted, and houses torched. He says the UNHCR and its partners urgently need more money to develop a new site in Zambia and provide life-saving assistance for the expanding refugee population. He says humanitarian activities in DRC and Zambia are hugely underfunded, noting less than one quarter of the $236 million needed to run this operation has been received. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Economic migrants from Zimbabwe are facing new challenges in Botswana. This after President Seretse Khama Iyankama announced new stringent requirements to acquire a work permit. For VOA, Martin Ngwenya has more from the Botswana capital, Gaborone.
The Botswana president told a recent meeting of the country's annual High-Level Consultative Council, HLCC, more locals need to be the focus of employment opportunities. The HLCC brings together government and private sector to discuss major social and economic challenges. President Khama said that for every expatriate recruited within a given organization, there should be between 3 and 5 locals employed. This will affect the nearly 6,000 expatriate workers in Botswana. Nearly half of them come from Zimbabwe. Some Zimbabweans say before President's announcement, a number of their fellow countrymen and women had their work permit applications rejected. Just over 3 years ago, there were more than 7,000 Zimbabweans legally working in Botswana, but that number has been significantly slashed. Matthews Chikofa is a Zimbabwean labor consultant based in the capital, Gaborone. He says the latest announcement by the president will have an adverse impact on the future of the nearly 3,000 Zimbabweans legally working in Botswana.
The latest announcement by President Iyankama will obviously impact on Zimbabweans who are the majority permit holders in Botswana. As labor consultants, we see a likely increase in the number of rejections of work permits. And I think the move will also affect Zimbabweans who have turned to Botswana in large numbers due to the economic meltdown back home.
Endai Ndlovu works as an accountant at a local firm. He fears for his future and that of his fellow countrymen and women following the recent announcement.
The pronouncements by the president of Botswana, President Iyankama, though we understand the implications behind it, but it's going to affect a lot of Zimbabweans because most of them are renewing permits. They have been here for periods ranging from 5 years to 15 years. They have so many commitments to look forward to, And admittedly, we know the economy in Zimbabwe will improve, but this is not an event, it's a process. So Zimbabweans will need time.
But while the government makes it tougher to get work permits, thousands of other Zimbabweans illegally enter the diamond-rich neighboring country in search of opportunities. It is estimated that 100,000 Zimbabweans illegally reside in Botswana, where they survive on odd jobs, even those who are well-educated. Reporting for VOA's English to Africa service, this is Martin Ngwenya in Habron, Botswana.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. See this loving way I get, he's gonna take away your sorrow. See this loving way I get, he's gonna day until tomorrow. See this loving way I get, take the lead and I will follow. Baby, always, always, oh. My don't eat tomato, my sweetest potato. I bet just stop it, though. Come on, get what I call. Like
mad. Cause the way you pull it down, make me want to go mad. Oh my God, girl, the way you grind. Anytime I see you, I'm blind. The way you handle that. Uku.
Yes. Mix Monster. Mix Monster.
Plenty, plenty. baga. Gotta they make my head the turn. Gotta they make my head the bang. Gotta they make my head the scatter. Hey, I'm looking for Caro. Eva, show me Caro. Eva, Susie Caro. Eva, where are you Caro? Eva, I'm looking for Caro. Eva, show me Caro. Eva, Susie Caro. Eva, where are you Caro? Caro they make my head the turn. She they make me turn around. Caro they make my head the turn. She they make me lose.
That was our Sunday music spot. I hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last week, President Emmanuel Macron of France began an official visit to West Africa. You may recall that Macron was elected 6 months ago in France, and during the campaign, he promised that he would like to review France's relationship with the African continent. You may also recall that the long-standing French relationship with Africa or French colony was during and after the Second World War, when Vichy France under Pétain was in control of the French colonies in Africa. De Gaulle began to see to attract the attention. And when the Allied powers invaded North Africa, one by one, the French colonies detached their allegiance to Vichy France and joined Free France led by De Gaulle. General De Gaulle never forgot that allegiance of the colonies. And after the Second World War, he shaped what became a paternalistic relationship between France and its colonies. This may explain why De Gaulle was outraged when Sékou Touré of Guinea followed the example of Ghana and declared independence from France. Now Macron wants to take a new look because he belongs to a new generation of French people who in fact had little or no knowledge of the French colonies in Africa. The approach began a week after he was elected when he visited Mali where you have 4,000 French troops engaged in the war against terrorism. Now, he has set up a committee in France to look at the relationship, and they are now trying to test those views as to what should be France's relationship with Africa in the trip last week. And contrary to past efforts, he began his trip in Burkina Faso, and he focused more on the youth. He spoke to 800 students in Ouagadougou University, knowing full well that France's prestige is waning in Africa, particularly among the youth. In his speech, he made it clear that France does not want to be in the position to tell Africans what they should do. And he offered them a tantalizing gift by saying that France would declassify his secret file on the assassination of Sangara, who is popular among the youth. Next, he went to La Côte d'Ivoire, where there was a meeting of a summit between Europe and the African Union. And there, the focus was on emigration and tackling the awful story of slavery in Libya. And then Macron became the first French president to visit Ghana. And being a man who belongs to financial communities, investment banker, his focus was more on trade with Ghana. He speaks English very well because in his student days, he interned in the French embassy in Nigeria for 6 months. So he promised trade with Ghana, and the president, Nana Addo, in the discussion, said that he wanted Africans to break this great dependency in donors, and Macron fully agreed with him. The question now is, will Macron succeed where others have failed to reshape France's policy in Africa? The reason being that in France and in the African continent, there are very hard interest groups that want to maintain the relationship, business groups in France. And, for example, maintaining the CFA, which 14 countries in Africa accept and tied to the euro. Will that be loosened? And there are a lot of African leaders, French-speaking African leaders, who enjoy this relationship. And that will be the test for the future. In the coming days and weeks, the focus will be on President Macron and France as to how they are going to react to the disturbances in Cameroon. Are they going to prop up an authoritarian government, or are they going to urge that government to loose the reins? Similarly, though not a former French colony, how will France react to President Kabila, who is still failing to withdraw after this term has ended in the DRC? So these are the things we have to wait, and hopefully he may succeed. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor William Eagle, reporter and producer Douglas Mpuga, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, when the door is closed, you must learn to slide across the crack of the sill. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Through its binational commission with Nigeria, the U.S. hopes to find new areas of collaboration with regard to security cooperation, economic growth and development, and democracy and governance. In the northwest region of Nigeria, Boko Haram and ISIS West Africa have wrought a great deal of destruction on the Nigerian people, forcing more than 2 million to flee from their homes. Speaking in Nigeria, Deputy Secretary of State John Sullivan said, "I want to emphasize that the United States is Nigeria's partner in this fight. We are committed to helping the Nigerian people provide their own security." The U.S. has helped Nigeria modernize its military, but a military response alone in the Northeast cannot lead to sustained peace, said Deputy Secretary Sullivan. Nigeria's success requires improvements to the economy and governance off the battlefield, including credible investigations of human rights violations and mechanisms to hold those guilty accountable for their actions. To help those affected by Boko Haram rebuild their lives, Deputy Secretary Sullivan announced that the U.S. Agency for International Development will contribute an additional $45.5 million. The United States will continue to support food security and nutrition programs in Nigeria, including development programs focused on the northeastern states. Predictable economic policies and a transparent justice system are necessary to create an environment for growth and to attract businesses and investment to Nigeria. Sufficient energy resources are critical to fueling growth in Nigeria. Through the U.S. government's Power Africa initiative, the U.S. will help the Nigerian government serve the majority of Nigerians who currently lack access to electricity. In particular, Deputy Secretary Sullivan announced a $1.3 million project to address the shortage of gas available for gas-fired power plants under the Power Africa initiative. Finally, in addition to supporting the security and economic growth of Nigeria, the United States recognizes that good governance is necessary to sustain both over the long term. Fighting corruption and ensuring free and fair elections will make the government of Nigeria more accountable to its people and better equipped to secure its citizens and keep its economy growing. The United States looks forward to working with Nigeria to reach their shared security, development, and governance goals.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.